on toward the bay and separating Portland from Yarmouth. From here, we can just make out the barest section of it, an empty place marked with no lights, no boats, no buildings, impenetrable and strange and black. But I know that the wilds extend back, go on for miles and miles and miles all through the mainland, all across the country, like a monster reaching its tentacles around the civilized parts of the world. Maybe it was the race, or beating him to the buoys, or the fact that he didn't criticize me or my family when I told him about my mother. But in that moment, the giddiness and happiness is still flowing strong, and I feel like I could tell Alex anything, ask him anything. So I say, "Can I tell you a secret?" I don't wait for him to answer. I don't have to. And knowing that makes me feel dizzy and careless. I used to think about it a lot. The wilds, I mean. And what they were like. And the invalids. Whether they really existed. Out of the corner of my eye, I think I see him flinch slightly. So I press on. I used to sometimes think. I used to pretend that maybe my mom didn't die, you know? That maybe she'd only run away to the wilds. Not that that would be any better. I guess I just didn't want her to be gone for good. It was better to imagine her out there somewhere, singing. I break off, shaking my head, amazed that I feel so comfortable talking to Alex. Amazed and grateful. "What about you?" I say.
"What about me what?"
Alex is watching me with an expression I can't read. Like I've hurt him. Almost, but that doesn't make any sense. "Did you used to think about going to the wilds when you were little? Just for fun, I mean, like a game?" Alex squints, looks away from me and grimaces.
"Yeah, sure, a lot."
He reaches out and slaps the buoys.
"None of these. No walls to run into, no eyes. Freedom and space, places to stretch out.
I still think about the wild." I stare at him. Nobody uses words like that anymore. Freedom, space, old words.
"Still?
Even after this?" Without meaning to or thinking about it, I reach out and brush my fingers once against the three-pronged scar on his neck. He jerks away from my touch as though I've scalded him and I drop my hand, embarrassed.
"Lena,"
he says in the strangest voice, like my name is a sour thing, a word that tastes bad in his mouth. I know I shouldn't have touched him like that. I've overstepped my boundaries, and he's going to remind me of it, of what it means to be uncured. I think I would die of humiliation if he starts to lecture me, so to cover my discomfort, I'd start babbling. "Most cureds don't think about that kind of stuff. Carol, that's my aunt, she always said it was a waste of time. She always said there was nothing out there but animals and land and bugs. That all the talk of invalids was make-believe stuff, kids stuff. She said believing in invalids is the same thing as believing in werewolves or vampires. Remember how people used to say there were vampires in the wilds?" Alex smiles, but it's more like a wince.
"Lena, I have to tell you something."
His voice is a little stronger now, but something about his tone makes me afraid to let him speak. Now I can't stop talking. "Did it hurt? The procedure, I mean? My sister said it was no big deal, not with all the painkillers they give you, but my cousin Marcia used to say it was worse than anything, worse than having a baby, even though her second kid took, like, 15 hours to deliver." I break off, blushing, mentally cursing myself for the ridiculous conversational turn. I wish I could rewind back to last night's party when my brain was coming up empty. It's like I've been saving up for a case of verbal vomit. "I'm not scared, though!" I nearly scream as Alex again opens his mouth to speak. I am desperate to salvage the situation somehow. "My procedure's coming up. 60 days. It's dorky, huh? That I count, but I can't wait."
"Lena."
Alex's voice is stronger, more forceful now, and it finally stops me. He turns so that we're face to face. At that moment, my shoes skim off the sand bottom and I realize that the water is lapping up to my neck. The tide is coming in fast.
"Listen to me. I'm not who you think I am."
I have to fight to stand. All of a sudden, the currents tug and pull at me. It's always seemed this way. The tide goes out a slow drain, comes back in a rush. "What do you mean?" His eyes, shifting gold, amber, and animal's eyes, search my face, and without knowing why, I'm scared again.
I was never cured, he says. For a moment, I close my eyes and imagine I've misheard him, imagine I've only confused the shushing of the waves for his voice. But when I open my eyes, he's still standing there, staring at me, looking guilty, and something else. Sad, maybe? And I know I heard correctly. He says,
I never had the procedure.
You mean it didn't work? I say. My body is tingling, going numb, and I realize then how cold it is. You had the procedure and it didn't work, like what happened to my mom?
No, Lena, I...
He looks away, squinting, says under his breath,
I don't know how to explain.
Everything from the tips of my fingers through the roots of my hair now feels as if it's encased in ice. Disconnected images run through my head, a skipping movie reel. Alex standing on the observation deck, his hair like a crown of leaves, turning his head, showing the neat three-pronged scar just beneath his left ear, reaching out to me and saying,
I'm safe. I won't hurt you.
The words start rattling out of me again, but I don't feel them, hardly feel anything. It didn't work, and you've been lying about it. Lying so you could still go to school, still get a job, still get paired and matched and everything. But really, you're not... You're still... You might still be... I can't bring myself to say the word diseased, uncured, sick. I feel like I'll be sick.
No!
Alex's voice is so loud it startles me. I take a step back, sneakers slipping on the slick and uneven bottom of the ocean floor and nearly go under, but when Alex makes a move to touch me, I jerk backward out of his reach. Something hardens in his face like he's made a decision.
I'm telling you, I was never cured. Never paired or matched or anything. I was never even evaluated.
Impossible. The word barely squeezes itself out, a whisper. The sky is whirling above me, all blues and pinks and reds, swirling together until it looks like parts of the sky are bleeding.
Impossible. You have the scars. Scars, he corrects me a little more gently. Just scars, not the scars.
He looks away then, giving me a view of his neck.
Three tiny scars, an inverted triangle. Easy to replicate with a scalpel, a penknife, anything.
I close my eyes again. The waves swell around me, and the motion, the lift and the drop convinces me I really will throw up, right here in the water. I choke down the feeling, trying to hold back the realization that is battering at the back of my mind, threatening to overwhelm me, fighting back the feeling of drowning. I open my eyes and croak out, how?
You have to understand. Lena, I'm trusting you. Do you see that?
He's staring at me so intently I can feel his eyes like a touch, and I keep my eyes averted.
I didn't mean to. I didn't want to lie to you.
How? I repeat, louder now. Somehow my brain gets stuck on the word lie and makes an endless loop. No way to avoid evaluations unless you lie. No way to avoid procedure unless you lie. You must lie. For a moment, Alex is silent, and I think he's going to chicken out, refuse to tell me anything more. I almost wish he would. I'm desperate to rewind time, go back to the moment before he said my name in that strange tone of voice, go back to the triumphant, surging feeling of beating him to the buoys. We'll race back to the beach. We'll meet up tomorrow, try to wheedle some fresh crabs from the fishermen at the dock. But then he speaks.
I'm not from here, he says. I mean, I wasn't born in Portland. Not exactly.
He's speaking in the tone of voice that everyone uses when they're about to break you apart. Gentle, kind, even. Like they can make the news sound better just by speaking in a lullaby voice.
I'm sorry, Lena, but your mother was a troubled woman.
Like you won't somehow hear the violence underneath.
Where are you from?
I don't have to ask. I know already. The realization has broken, spilled, overrun me. But a little part of me believes that as long as he doesn't say it, it's not true. His eyes are steady on mine, but he tilts his head back, back toward the border, beyond the bridge to that endlessly moving arrangement of branches and leaves and vines and tangled growing things. There, he says. Or maybe I just think he says it. His lips barely move, but the meaning is clear. He comes from the wilds. An invalid, I say. The word feels like it's grating against my throat. You're an invalid. I'm giving him a final chance to deny it. But he doesn't. He just winces slightly and says,
I've always hated that word.
Standing there, I realize something else. That it wasn't a coincidence whenever Carol made fun of me for still believing in the invalids, whenever she would shake her head without bothering to look up from her knitting needles, tick, tick, tick. They went together, flashing metal, and say,
I suppose you believe in vampires and werewolves, too.
Vampires and werewolves and invalids, things that will rip into you, tear you to shreds, deadly things. I'm suddenly so frightened, a desperate pressure starts pushing down in the bottom of my stomach and between my legs, and for one wild and ridiculous second, I'm positive that I'm about to pee. The lighthouse on Little Diamond Island clicks on, cuts a wide swath across the water, an enormous accusatory finger. I'm terrified I'll get caught up in its beam, terrified it will point in my direction, and then I'll hear the whirling of the state helicopters and the megaphone voices of the regulators shouting, Illegal activity! Illegal activity! The beach looks hopelessly and impossibly remote. I can't imagine how we got out so far. My arms feel heavy and useless, and I think of my mother and her jacket filling slowly with water. I take deep breaths, trying to keep my mind from spinning, trying to focus. There's no way for anyone to know that Alex is an invalid. I didn't know. He looks normal, has the scar in the right place. There's no way anyone could have heard us talking. A wave lifts and breaks against my back. I stumble forward. Alex reaches out and grabs my arm to steady me, but I twist away from him just as a second round of waves surges over us. I get a mouthful of seawater, feel the salt stinging my eyes, and am momentarily blinded.
Don't! I stutter. Don't you dare touch me!
Lena,
I swear I didn't mean to hurt you. I didn't want to lie to you.
Why are you doing this?
I can't think straight, can hardly even breathe. What do you want from me?
Want?
Alex shakes his head. He looks genuinely confused and hurt, too, as though I'm the one who did something wrong. For a second, I feel a flash of sympathy for him. Maybe he sees it on my face, that fraction of a second when I let my guard down, because in that moment, his expression softens and his eyes go bright as flame, and even though I barely see him move, suddenly he has closed the space between us, and he's wrapping his warm hands over my shoulders, fingers so warm and strong I almost cry out, and saying,
Lena, I like you, okay? That's it. That's all. I like you.
His voice is so low and hypnotic, it reminds me of a song. I think of predators dropping silently from trees. I think of enormous cats with glowing amber eyes just like his. And then I'm stumbling backward, paddling away from him, my shirt and shoes heavy with water, my heart hammering painfully against my chest and my breath rasping in my throat. I'm kicking off the ground and sweeping forward with my arms, half running, half swimming as the tide lifts and drags at me, so I feel like I can only creep forward an inch at a time, so I feel like I'm moving through molasses. Alex calls my name, but I'm too afraid to turn my head and see if he's coming after me. It's like one of those nightmares where something's chasing you, but you're too afraid to look and see what it is. All you hear is its breath getting closer and closer. You feel its shadow looming up behind you, but you're paralyzed. You know that any second you'll feel its icy fingers closing on your neck. I'll never make it, I think. I'll never make it back. Something scrapes across my shin, and I begin to imagine that the bay around me is full of horrible underwater things. Sharks and jellyfish and poisonous eels, and even though I know I'm panicking, I feel like falling backward and giving up. The beach is still so far, and my arms and legs feel so heavy. Alex's voice gets whipped away by the wind, sounding fainter and fainter, and when I finally work up the courage to look over my shoulder, I see him bobbing up and down by the buoys. I realize I've gone farther than I thought.
And at the very least, Alex isn't following me. My fear eases up, and the knot in my chest loosens. The next wave is so strong it helps skim me over a steep underwater ridge, drops me to my knees into soft sand. When I struggle to my feet, the water hits me just at the waist, and I slosh the rest of the way to shore, shivering, grateful, exhausted. My thighs are shaking. I collapse onto the beach, gasping and coughing. From the flames of color licking across the sky over Back Cove, orange, reds, pinks, I'm guessing it's close to sunset, probably around 8 o'clock. Part of me wants to just lie down, spread my arms, and stretch out and sleep all through the night. I feel like I've swallowed half my weight in salt water. My skin stings and there's sand everywhere. In my bra and underwear and between my toes and under my fingernails. Whatever scraped my shin in the water left its mark. A long trickle of blood snakes around my calf. I look up, and for one panicked second, I can't find Alex by the buoys. My heart stops. Then I see him, a dark spot, cutting quickly through the water, his arms pinwheel gracefully as he swims. He's fast. I haul myself to my feet, grab my shoes, and limp up to my bike. My legs are so weak it takes me a minute to find my balance, and at first I weave crazily up and down the road like a toddler just learning to ride. I don't look back. Not once. Until I'm at my gate. By then the streets are empty and quiet. Night about to fall. Curfew about to come down like a giant warm embrace. Keeping us all in our places. Keeping us all safe. Chapter 11. Think of it this way. When it's cold outside and your teeth are chattering, you bundle up in a winter coat and scarves and mittens to keep from catching the flu. Well, the borders are like hats and scarves and winter coats for the whole country. They keep the very worst disease away so we can all stay healthy. After the borders went up, the president and the consortium had one last thing to take care of before we could all be safe and happy. The Great Sanitation, sometimes called the Blitz, lasted less than a month, but afterward, all the wild spaces were cleared of the disease. We went in there with some old-fashioned elbow grease and scrubbed the problem spots away, just like when your mom wipes the kitchen counters down with a sponge. Easy as 1, 2, 3. Sanitation. Number 1, the application of sanitary measures for the sake of cleanliness or protecting health. Number 2, the disposal of sewage and waste. Excerpt from Dr. Richard's History Primer for Children, Chapter 1. Here is a secret about my family. My sister contracted the delirious several months before her scheduled procedure. She fell in love with a boy named Thomas, who was also uncured. During the day, she and Thomas spent all their time lying in a field of wildflowers, shielding their eyes against the sun, whispering promises to each other that could never be kept. She cried all the time, and once she confessed to me that Thomas liked to kiss away her tears. Still now, when I think of those days, I was only 8 at the time, I think of the taste of salt. The disease slowly worked its way deeper and deeper inside of her, an animal chewing her from within. My sister couldn't eat. What little we could convince her to swallow came up just as quickly, and I was afraid for her life. Thomas broke her heart, of course, to nobody's surprise. The Book of Shh says, "Amor deliria nervosa produces shifts in the prefrontal cortex of the brain, which result in fantasies and delusions that, once revealed, lead in turn to psychic devastation." See Effects, page 36. Then my sister did nothing but lie in bed and watch the shadows shift slowly across the walls, her ribs rising up under her pale skin like wood rising through water. Even then, she refused the procedure and the comfort it would give her. And on the day the cure was to be administered, it took 4 scientists and several needles full of tranquilizer before she would submit, before she would stop scratching with her long, sharp nails, which had gone uncut for weeks, and screaming and cursing and calling for Thomas. I watched them come for her, to bring her to the labs. I sat in a corner, terrified, while she spit and hissed and kicked. And I thought of my mom and dad. That afternoon, though I was still more than a decade away from safety, I began to count the months until my procedure. In the end, my sister was cured. She came back to me gentle and content, her nails spotless and round, her hair pulled back in a long, thick braid. Several months later, she was pledged to an IT tech, roughly her age. And several weeks after she graduated from college, they married, their hands linked loosely under the canopy, both of them staring straight ahead as though at a future of days unmarred by worry or discontent or disagreement. A future of identical days, like a series of neatly blown bubbles. Thomas was cured, too. He was married to Ella, once my sister's best friend, and now everybody is happy. Rachel told me a few months ago that the two couples often see each other at picnics and neighborhood events, since they live fairly close to each other in the East End. The four of them sit, making polite and quiet conversation, with not a soul flicker of the past to disturb the stillness and completeness of the present. That's the beauty of the cure. No one mentions those lost, hot days in the field when Thomas kissed Rachel's tears away and invented worlds just so he could promise them to her, when she tore the skin off her own arms at the thought of living without him. I'm sure she's embarrassed by those days, if she remembers them at all. True, I don't see her that often now, just once every couple of months, when she remembers she's supposed to stop by, and in that way, I guess you could say that even with the procedure, I lost a little bit of her. But that's not the point. The point is that she's protected. The point is that she's safe. I'll tell you another secret. This one for your own good. You may think the past has something to tell you. You may think that you should listen, should strain to make out its whispers, should bend over backward, stoop down low to hear its voice breathed up from the ground, from the dead places. You may think there's something in it for you, something to understand or make sense of. But I know the truth. I know from the nights of coldness. I know the past will drag you backward and down, have you snatching at whispers of wind and the gibberish of trees rubbing together, trying to decipher some code, trying to piece together what was broken. It's hopeless. The past is nothing but a weight. It will build inside of you like a stone. Take it from me. If you hear the past speaking to you, feel it tugging at your back and running its fingers up your spine, the best thing to do, the only thing, is run. In the days that follow Alex's confession, I check constantly for symptoms of the disease. When I'm manning the register at my uncle's store, I lean forward on my elbow, keep my hand resting on my cheek so I can crook my fingers back toward my neck and count my pulse, make sure it's normal. In the mornings, I take long, slow breaths, listening for rasping or hitches in my lungs. I wash my hands constantly. I know the deliria isn't like a cold, you can't get it from being sneezed on, but still, it's contagious. And when I woke up the day after our meeting at East End with my limbs still heavy and my head as light as a bubble and an ache in my throat that refused to go away, my first thought was that I'd been infected. After a few days, I feel better. The only weird thing is the way my senses seem to have dulled. Everything looks washed out, like a bad color copy. I have to load my food with salt before I can taste it, and every time my aunt speaks to me, it seems like her voice has been muted a few degrees. But I read through the Book of Shh, and all the recognized symptoms of deliria, and don't see anything that matches up, so in the end, I figure I'm safe. Still, I take precautions. Determined not to make one false step, determined to prove to myself that I'm not like my mother, that the thing with Alex was a fluke, a mistake, a horrible, horrible accident. I can't ignore how close I was to danger. I don't even want to think about what would happen if anyone found out what Alex was, if anyone knew that we had stood together shivering in the water, that we'd talked, laughed, touched. It makes me feel sick. I have to keep repeating to myself that my procedure is less than 2 months away now. All I have to do is keep my head down and make it through the next 7 weeks, and I'll be fine. I come home every evening a full 2 hours before curfew. I volunteer to spend extra days at the store, and I don't even ask for my usual $8 an hour wage. Hannah doesn't call me. I don't call her either. I help my aunt cook dinner, and I clear and wash the dishes unprompted. Gracie is in summer school. She's only in first grade, and they're already talking about holding her back. And every night I pull her onto my lap and help her sludge through her work, whispering in her ear, begging her to speak, to focus, to listen, cajoling her finally into writing at least
half of the answers down in her workbook. After a week, my aunt stops looking at me suspiciously whenever I walk into the house, stops demanding to know where I've been, and another weight eases off me. She trusts me again. It wasn't easy to explain why on Earth Sophia Henderson and I would decide on an impromptu swim in the ocean, in our clothes, no less, just after a big family dinner. Even harder to explain why I came home pale and shaking, and I could tell my aunt didn't buy it. But after a while, she relaxes around me again, stops looking at me distrustfully, like I'm some caged-up animal she's worried will go feral. Days pass, time ticks away, seconds click forward like dominoes toppling in a line. Every day the heat gets worse and worse. It creeps through the streets of Portland, festers in the dumpsters, makes the city smell like a giant armpit. The walls sweat and the trolleys cough and shudder, and every day people gather in front of the municipal buildings, praying for a brief blast of cold air whenever the mechanized doors swoosh open because a regulator or politician or guard has to go in and out. I have to give up my runs. The last time I do a full loop outside, I find that my feet carry me down to Monument Square past the governor. The sun is a high white haze. All the buildings cut sharply against the sky like a series of metal teeth. By the time I make it to the statue, I'm panting, exhausted, and my head is spinning. When I grab the governor's arm and swing myself up onto the statue's base, the metal burns underneath my hand and the world seesaws crazily, light zigzagging everywhere. I'm dimly aware that I should go inside, out of the heat, but my brain is all foggy, and so there I go, poking my fingers around the hole in the governor's cupped fist. I don't know what I'm looking for. Alex already told me that the note he'd left for me months ago must have turned to pulp by now. My fingers come out sticky, pieces of melting gum stringing between my thumb and forefinger. But still I root around, and then I feel it slide between my fingers, cool and crisp, folded in a square. A note. I'm half delirious as I open it. But still, I don't really expect it to be from him. My hands begin to shake as I read.
Lena, I'm so sorry. Please forgive me.
Alex. I don't remember the run home, and my aunt finds me later half passed out in the hallway murmuring to myself. She has to put me in a bathtub full of ice to get my temperature down. When I finally come to, I can't find the note anywhere. I realize I must have dropped it and feel half relieved and half disappointed. That evening, we read that the time and temperature building registered 102 degrees, the hottest day on record for the summer so far. My aunt forbids me to run outside for the rest of the summer. I don't put up a fight. I don't trust myself. Can't be sure my feet won't lead me back down to the governor, to East End Beach, to the labs. I receive a new date for the evaluations and spend my evenings in front of the mirror rehearsing my answers. My aunt insists on accompanying me to the labs again, but this time I don't see Hannah. I don't see anyone I recognize. Even the four evaluators are different. Floating oval faces, different shades of brown and pink, two-dimensional, like shaded drawings. I'm not afraid this time. I don't feel anything. I answer all the questions exactly as I should. When I'm asked to give my favorite color, for just the briefest, tiniest of seconds, my mind flashes on a sky the color of polished silver, and I think I hear a word.
Gray,
whispered quietly into my ear. I say, blue, and everyone smiles. I say, I'd like to study psychology and social regulation. I say, I like to listen to music, but not too loudly. I say, the definition of happiness is security. Smile, smile, smiles all around, a room full of teeth. After I'm done, as I'm leaving, I think I see a shifting shadow, a flicker in my peripheral vision. I glance up quickly at the observation deck. Of course, it's empty. 2 days later, we receive the results of my boards. All passes, and my final score, 8. My aunt hugs me the first time she has hugged me in years. My uncle pats me on the shoulder awkwardly and gives me the largest piece of chicken at dinner. Even Jenny looks impressed. Gracie rams the top of her head into my leg 1, 2, 3 times, and I step away from her, tell her to stop fussing. I know she's upset that I'll be leaving her. But that's life. and the sooner she gets used to it, the better. I receive my approved matches, too. A list of 4 names and statistics. Age, scores, interests, recommended career path, salary projections. Printed neatly on a white sheet of paper with the Portland City crest at its top. At least Andrew Marcus isn't on it. I recognize only one name, Chris McDonnell. He has bright red hair and teeth that stick out like a rabbit's. I only know him because once when I was playing outside last year with Gracie, he started chanting, "There goes the retard and the orphan." And without really thinking about what I was doing, I scooped up a rock from the ground and turned around and hurled it in his direction. It caught him on the temple. For a second, his eyes crossed and uncrossed. He lifted his fingers to his head, and when he pulled them away, they were dark with blood. For days afterward, I was terrified to go out, terrified I'd be arrested and thrown in the crypts. Mr. McDonnell owned a tech services firm and was a volunteer regulator besides. I was convinced he would come after me for what I'd done to his son. Chris McDonnell, Phineas Johnston, Edward Wung, Brian Scharf. I stare at the names for so long that the letters rearrange themselves into nonsense words, into baby babble. Gone crap, just fine, won't spill, pick Chris, sharp things. In mid-July, when my procedure is only 7 weeks away, it's time to make my decision. I rank my choices arbitrarily, inserting numbers next to names. Phineas Johnston, 1. Chris McDonnell, 2. Brian Scharf, 3. Edward Wong, 4. The boys will be submitting their rankings, too. The evaluators will do their best to match preferences. 2 days later, I receive the official notification. I'll be spending the rest of my life with Brian Scharf, whose hobbies are watching the news and fantasy baseball, and who plans to work in the Electricians Guild, and who can someday expect to make $45,000, a salary that should support 2 to 3 kids. I'll be pledged to him before I begin Regional College of Portland in the fall. When I graduate, we'll be married. At night, I sleep dreamlessly. In the mornings, I wake to fog. Chapter 12. In the decades before the development of the cure, the disease had become so virulent and widespread it was extraordinarily rare for a person to reach adulthood without having contracted a significant case of Amor Deliria Nervosa. Please see statistics, pre-border era. Many historians have argued that pre-cure society was itself a reflection of the disease, characterized by fracture, chaos, and instability. Almost half of all marriages ended in dissolution. Incidents of drug use skyrocketed, as did alcohol-related deaths. People were so desperate for relief and protection from the disease, they began widespread experimentation with makeshift folk remedies that were in themselves deadly. Consuming concoctions of drugs assembled from common cold medications and synthesized into an extremely addictive and often fatal compound. Please see Folk Cures Through the Ages. The discovery of the procedure to cure deliria is typically credited to Cormac T. Holmes, a neuroscientist who was a member of the initial consortium of new scientists and one of the first disciples of the new religion, which teaches the Holy Trinity of God, science, and order. Holmes was canonized several years after his death, and his body was preserved and displayed in the All Saints Monument in Washington, D.C. See photographs on pages 210 to 212. From Before the Border, A Brief History of the United States of America, by E.D. Thompson, page 121. One hot evening toward the end of July, I'm walking home from the Stop and Save when I hear someone call my name. I turn around and see Hannah jogging up the hill toward me. "So what?" she says as she gets closer, panting a little. "You're just gonna walk by me now?" The obvious hurt in her voice surprises me. "I didn't see you," I say, which is the truth. "I'm tired. Today we did inventory at the store, unshelving and reshelving packages of diapers, canned goods, rolls of paper towels, counting and recounting everything. My arms are aching, and whenever I close my eyes, I see barcodes. I'm so tired, I'm not even embarrassed to be out in public wearing my paint-spotted Stop and Save t-shirt, which is about 10 sizes too big for me." Hannah looks away, biting her lip. I haven't spoken to her since that night at the party, and I'm searching desperately for something to say, something casual and normal. It suddenly seems incredible to me that this was my best friend. That we could hang out for days and never run out of things to talk about. That I would come home from her house with my throat sore from laughing. It's like there's a glass wall between us now. Invisible but impenetrable. I finally come up with, I got my matches. At the same time that Hannah blurts out, why didn't you call me back? Both of us pause, startled, and then again start up at the same time. I say, you called? And Hannah says, did you accept yet? You first, I say. Hannah actually seems uncomfortable. She looks at the sky, at a small child standing across the street in a baggy swimsuit, at the two men loading buckets of something into a truck down the street, everywhere but at me. I left you, like, 3 messages. I never got any messages, I say quickly, my heart speeding up. For weeks, I've been pissed that Hannah didn't try to reach out to me after the party. Pissed and hurt. But I told myself it was better this way. I told myself Hannah had changed, and she probably wouldn't have much to say to me anymore. Hannah's looking at me like she's trying to judge whether I'm telling the truth. Carol didn't tell you that I called? No, I swear. I'm so relieved I laugh. In that second, it hits me just how much I've missed Hannah. Even when she's mad at me, she's the only person who's ever really looked out for me by choice, not because of family obligation and duty and responsibility and all the other stuff that the Book of Shh says is so important. Everyone else in my life, Carol and all my cousins, the other girls at St. Anne's, even Rachel, have only spent time with me because they had to. I had no idea. Hannah doesn't laugh, though. She frowns. No worries. It's no big deal. Listen, Hannah, she cuts me off. Like I said, it's no big deal. She crosses her arms and shrugs. I don't know whether she believes me or not, but it's clear that, after all, things are different. This isn't going to be some big, happy reunion. So, you got matched? Her voice is polite now and slightly formal, so I take on the same tone. Brian Scharf, I accepted. You? She nods. A muscle flexes at the corner of her mouth, almost imperceptible. Fred Hargrove. Hargrove? Like the mayor? His son. Hannah nods, looks away again. Wow, congratulations. I can't help sounding impressed. Hannah must have killed at the evaluations. Not that that's any surprise, really. Yeah, lucky me. Hannah's voice is completely toneless. I can't tell if she's being sarcastic, but she is lucky, whether she knows it or not. And there it is. Even though we're standing in the same patch of sun-drenched pavement, we might as well be 100,000 miles apart. You came from different starts, and you'll come to different ends. That's an old saying, something Carol used to repeat a lot. I never really understood how true it was until now. This must be why Carol didn't tell me Hannah called. 3 phone calls is a lot of phone calls to forget, and Carol's pretty careful about stuff like that. Maybe she was trying to hurry up the inevitable. Skip us both to the ending, the part where Hannah and I aren't friends anymore. She knows that after the procedure, once the past and all our shared history has loosened its grip on us, once we don't feel our memories so much, we won't have anything in common. Carol was probably trying to protect me in her own way. There's no point in confronting her about it. She won't try and deny it. She'll just give me one of her blank looks and rattle off a proverb from the Book of Shh. Feelings aren't forever. Time waits for no man, but progress waits for man to enact it. You walking home? Hannah is still looking at me like I'm a stranger. Yeah, I say. I gesture to my t-shirt. I figured I should probably get inside before I blind someone with this. A smile flits over Hannah's face. I'll walk with you, she says, which surprises me. For a while, we walk in silence. We're not that far from my house, and I'm worried we'll go the whole way back without speaking at all. I've never seen Hannah so quiet, and it's making me nervous. Where are you coming from? I say, just to say something. Hannah starts next to me as though I've woken her from a dream. East End, she says. I'm on a strict tanning schedule. She presses her arm next to mine. It's at least 7 shades darker than mine, which is still pale. Maybe a little more freckled than it is in the winter. Not you, huh? This time she smiles for real. No, Haven't gotten down to the beach very much. I will away a blush. Thankfully, Hannah doesn't notice, or if she does, she doesn't say anything. I know, I was looking for you.
You were?
I shoot her a look from the corner of my eye. She rolls her eyes. I'm glad to see her attitude is coming back online.
I mean, not actively, but I've been down there a few times, yeah.
Haven't seen you.
I've been working a lot, I say.
I don't add to avoid East End, actually.
You still running?
No, too hot.
Yeah, me too. Figured I'd give it a rest until fall.
We walk a few more paces in silence, and then Hannah squints at me, tilting her head.
So? What else?
Her question catches me off guard.
What do you mean,
what else?
That is what I mean. I mean, what else?
Come on, Lena. It's the last summer, remember? The last summer of no responsibilities and all that good stuff.
So what have you been doing?
Where have you been?
Nothing. I haven't done anything.
This was the whole point, to stay out of trouble, to do as little as possible, but saying the words makes me feel kind of sad. The summer seems to be narrowing rapidly, shrinking down to a fine point before I've even had a chance to enjoy it. It's already almost August. We'll have another 5 weeks of this weather before the wind starts cutting in at night and the leaves get trimmed with edges of gold.
What about you?
I say.
Good summer so far?
The usual, Hannah shrugs. I've been going to the beach a lot, like I said. Been babysitting for the ferals some.
Really?
I wrinkle my nose. Hannah's always had a thing against children. She's always saying they're too sticky and clingy, like Jolly Ranchers that have been left too long in a hot pocket. She makes a face.
Yeah, unfortunately.
My parents decided I needed to practice managing a household or some crap like that. You know, they're actually making me work out a budget. Like, figuring out how to spend $60 a week is going to teach me about paying bills or responsibility or something.
Why?
It's not like you'll even have a budget. I don't mean to sound bitter, but there it is. The difference in our futures cutting between us again. We go silent after that. Hannah looks away, squinting slightly against the sunlight. Maybe I'm just feeling depressed about how quickly the summer is cycling by, but memories start coming thick and fast, like a deck of cards being reshuffled in my head. Hannah swinging open the bathroom door that first day in second grade, folding her arms as she blurted out, "Is it because of your mom?" Staying up past midnight one of the few times we were ever allowed to have a sleepover, giggling and imagining amazing and impossible people for our matches someday, like the President of the United States or the stars of our favorite movies, running side by side, legs beating in tandem on the pavement like the rhythm of a single heartbeat, body surfing at the beach and buying triple cones of ice cream on the way home, arguing about whether vanilla or chocolate was better. Best friends for more than 10 years, and in the end, it all comes down to the edge of a scalpel, to the motion of a laser beam through the brain and a flashing surgical knife. All that history and its importance gets detached, floats away like a severed balloon. In 2 years, in 2 months, Hannah and I will pass each other on the streets with nothing more than a nod. Different people, different worlds, two stars revolving silently, separated by thousands of miles of dark space. Segregation has it all wrong. We should be protected from the people who will leave us in the end, from all the people who will disappear or forget us. Maybe Hannah's feeling nostalgic too because she suddenly comes out with, "Remember all our plans for this summer? All the things we said we'd finally do?" I don't even skip a beat. Break into the Spencer Prep pool
and go swimming in our underwear?
Hannah finishes. I crack a smile. Hop the fence at Cherry Hill Farms
and eat the maple syrup straight out of the barrels.
Run all the way from the hill to the old airport.
Ride our bikes down Suicide Point.
Try and find that rope swing Sarah Miller told us about, the one above Four River.
Sneak into the movie theater and see 4 movies back to back.
Finish off the Hobgoblin Sunday at Mays. I'm fully smiling now, and Hannah is too. I start quoting, "A gargantuan sundae for enormous appetites only, featuring 13 scoops, whipped cream, hot fudge." Hannah jumps in.
"And all the toppings your little monsters can handle."
Both of us laugh. We've probably read that sign 1,000 times. We've been debating making a second attack on the hobgoblin since 4th grade. That's when we tried the first time. Hannah insisted on going there for her birthday and took me along. Both of us spent the rest of the night rolling around on the floor of her bathroom, and we'd only made it through 7 of the 13 scoops. We reached my street. A few kids are playing in the middle of the road. It's a makeshift game of soccer. They're kicking a can around and shouting, bodies brown and shiny with sweat. I see Jenny among them. As I'm watching, a girl tries to elbow her out of the way, and Jenny turns around and pushes her to the ground. The younger girl starts to wail. No one comes out of any of the houses, even as the girl's voice crescendos to a high-pitched scream like a siren going off. A curtain or dish towel flutters in a window. Other than that, the street is silent, motionless. I'm desperate to keep riding the wave of good feeling, to fix things between Hannah and me, even if it's only for a month. Listen, Hannah, I feel like I'm working the words past an enormous lump in my throat. I'm almost as nervous as I was before the evaluations. They're playing the defective detective in the park tonight, double feature Michael Wynn. We could go if you want. The Defective Detective is this film franchise Hannah and I used to love when we were little, about a famous detective who's actually incompetent and his dog sidekick. The dog always ends up solving the crimes. A lot of actors have played the lead role, but our favorite was Michael Wynn. When we were kids, we used to pray to get matched with him. Tonight? Hannah's smile falters and my stomach sinks. Stupid, I think. It doesn't matter anyway. It's okay if you can't, no worries, just an idea. I say quickly, looking away so she won't see how disappointed I am. No, I mean, I want to, but... Hannah sucks in a breath. I hate this. Hate how awkward we both are. I kind of have this party... She corrects herself quickly. This thing I'm supposed to go to with Angelica Marston. My stomach gets that hollowed-out feeling. It's amazing how words can do that. Just shred your insides apart. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. Such bullshit. Since when do you hang out with Angelica Marston? Again, I'm not trying to sound bitter, but I realize I sound like someone's whiny little sister complaining about being left out of a game. I bite my lip and turn away, furious with myself. She's actually not that bad, Hannah says mildly. I can hear it in her voice. She feels sorry for me. This is worse than anything. I almost wish we were screaming at each other again like we did the day at her house. Even that would be better than her careful tone of voice, the way we're dancing around each other's feelings. She's not really stuck up, just shy, I guess. Angelica Marston was a junior last year. Hannah made fun of her for the way she wore her uniform. It was always perfectly pressed and spotless, the collar of her button-down turned down exactly, her skirt hitting exactly at the knee. Hannah said Angelica Marston had a stick up her butt because her father was a big scientist at the labs. And she did kind of walk that way, all constipated and careful. You used to hate her, I squeak out. My words don't seem to be asking my brain for permission before popping out of my mouth. I didn't hate her. Hannah says, like she's trying to explain algebra to a 2-year-old. I didn't know her. I always thought she was a bitch, you know, because of her clothes and stuff, but that's all her parents. They're super strict, really protective and stuff. Hannah shakes her head. She's not like that at all. She's different. That word seems to vibrate in the air for a second. Different. For a second, I have an image of Hannah and Angelica, arms linked, trying not to laugh, sneaking through the streets after curfew. Angelica, fearless and beautiful and fun, just like Hannah. I push the image out of my head. Down the street, one of the kids kicks the can hard. It skitters between 2 dented silver garbage cans that have been set out in the road, a makeshift goal. Half of the kids start jumping up and down, pumping their fists. The others, Jenny included, gesticulate and yell something about offsides. It occurs to me for the first time how ugly my street must look to Hannah. All the houses squished together, half of them missing window panes, porches sagging in the middle like old, beaten-down mattresses. It's so different from the clean, quiet streets in West End.
from the silent, gleaming cars and the gates and the green hedges.
You could come tonight, Hannah says quietly.
A rush of hatred overwhelms me. Hatred for my life, for its narrowness and cramped spaces. Hatred for Angelica Marston with her secretive smile and rich parents. Hatred for Hannah for being so stupid and careless and stubborn, first and foremost, and for leaving me behind before I was ready to be left. And underneath all those layers, something else, too. Some white-hot blade of unhappiness flashing in the very deepest part of me. I can't name it or even focus on it clearly, but somehow I understand that this other thing, makes me the angriest of all.
Thanks for the invitation, I say, not even bothering to keep the sarcasm out of my voice. Sounds like a blast. Will there be boys there, too?
Either Hannah doesn't notice the tone of my voice, which is doubtful, or she chooses to ignore it.
That's kind of the whole point, she says deadpan.
Well, and the music.
Music? I say. I can't help but sound interested. Like the last time?
Hannah's face lights up. Yeah. I mean, no, different band, but these guys are supposed to be amazing, even better than last time.
She pauses, then repeats quietly, "You could come with us." Despite everything, this gives me pause.
In the days after the party at Roaring Brook Farms, snatches of music seemed to follow me everywhere. I heard it winging in and out of the wind. I heard it singing off the ocean and moaning through the walls of the house. Sometimes I woke up in the middle of the night, drenched in sweat, my heart pounding with the notes sounding in my ears. But every time I was awake and trying to remember the melodies consciously, hum a few notes or recall any of the chords, I couldn't.
Hannah's staring at me hopefully, waiting for my response. For a second, I actually feel bad for her. I want to make her happy like I always did. I want to see her give a whoop and put her fist in the air and flash me one of her famous smiles. But then I remember she has Angelica Marston now, and something hardens in my throat. And knowing that I'm going to disappoint her gives me a kind of dull satisfaction.
I think I'll pass, I say. But thanks anyway.
Hannah shrugs, and I can tell she's fighting to look like it's no big deal.
If you change your mind, she tries to smile, but can't keep it up for longer than a second.
Tangle Wild Lane, Deering Highlands. You know where to find me.
Deering Highlands.
Of course. The Highlands is an abandoned subdivision off peninsula. A decade ago, the government discovered sympathizers and, if the rumors are true, even some invalids living together in one of the big mansions out there. It was a huge scandal, and the bust the result of a year-long sting operation. When all was said and done, 42 people had been executed and another 100 thrown in the crypts. Since then, Deering Highlands has been a ghost town, avoided, forgotten, condemned.
Yeah, well, you know where to find me, I gesture lamely down the street.
Yeah, Hannah looks down at her feet, hops from one to the other. There's nothing else to say, but I can't stand to turn around and just walk away. I have a terrible feeling this is the last time I'll see Hannah before we're cured. Fear seizes me all at once, and I wish I could backpedal through our conversation, take back all the sarcastic or mean things that I said, tell her I miss her and I want to be best friends again. But just when I'm about to blurt this out, she gives me a quick wave and says, "Okay then, see you around." And the moment collapses in on itself, and with it, my chance to speak.
Okay. See you.
Hannah starts off down the road. I'm tempted to watch her go. I get the urge to memorize her walk, to imprint her in my brain somehow, just as she is. But as I'm watching her waver in and out of the fierce sunlight, her silhouette gets confused with another one in my head. A shadow weaving in and out of darkness, about to walk off the cliff, and I don't know who I'm looking at anymore. Suddenly, the edges of the world are blurring, and there's a sharp pain in my throat, so I turn around and walk quickly toward the house.
Lena! She calls out to me just before I reach the gate.
I spin around, heart leaping, thinking maybe she'll be the one to say it. I miss you. Let's go back. Even from a distance of 50 feet, I can see Hannah hesitating. Then she makes this fluttering gesture with her hand and calls out,
Never mind. This time when she turns around, she doesn't waver. She walks straight and quickly, turns a corner, and is gone. But what did I expect? That's the whole point, after all. There's no going back. Chapter 13. In the years before the cure was perfected, it was offered on a trial basis only. The risks attached to it were great. At the time, 1 out of every 100 patients suffered a fatal loss of brain function after the procedure. Nonetheless, people swarmed the hospitals in record number, demanding to be cured. They camped outside the laboratories for days at a time, hoping to secure a procedural slot. These years are also known as the miracle years because of the quantity of lives that were healed and made whole, and the number of souls brought out of sickness. And if there were people who died on the operating table, they died for a good cause, and no one can lament them. From The Miracle Years, The Early Science of the Cure, A Brief History of the United States of America, by E.D. Thompson, page 87. When I get into the house, it's even hotter than usual. A wet, suffocating wall of heat. Carol must be cooking. The house smells like browned meat and spices, mixed with the normal summer smells of sweat and mildew. It's kind of nauseating. For the past few weeks, we've been eating dinner out on the porch. Runny macaroni salads, cold cuts, and sandwiches from my uncle's deli counter. Carol pokes her head out of the kitchen as I go by. Her face is red and she's sweating big time. Dark swaths of sweat have left pit stains on her pale blue blouse, navy crescents. "Better get changed," she says. "Rachel and David will be here any second." I'd completely forgotten my sister and her husband were coming over for dinner. Normally, I see Rachel 4 or 5 times a year, tops. When I was younger, especially after Rachel had first moved out of Carol's house, I used to count the days until she would come and see me. I don't think I fully understood then about the procedure and what it meant for her, for me, for us. I knew that she'd been saved from Thomas and from the disease, but that was it. I think I thought that otherwise things would be exactly the same. I thought that as soon as she came to see me, it would be like old times again, that we would bust out our socks to have a dance party, or she would pull me onto her lap and start braiding my hair, launch into one of her stories of distant places and witches who could change into animals. But she only skimmed a hand over my head as she came through the door and applauded politely when Carol made me recite my multiplication and division tables. "She's grown up now," Carol told me when I asked her why Rachel didn't like to play anymore. "Someday, you'll see." After that, I stopped paying attention to the notation that appeared every few months on the kitchen wall calendar, R to visit. At dinner, the big topics of conversation are Brian Scharf. Rachel's husband David works with Brian's cousin's friend, so David feels like he's an expert on the family. And Regional College of Portland, where I'll be starting in the fall. It's the first time in my life I'll be in class with members of the opposite sex. But Rachel tells me not to worry.
"You won't even notice," she says. "You'll be so busy with work and studying."
"There are safeguards," says Aunt Carol. "All the students are vetted." Code for all the students are cured. I think of Alex and almost say, "Not all of them." Dinner drags on well past curfew. By the time my aunt helps me clear the plates, it's almost 11 o'clock, and still Rachel and her husband make no sign to leave. That's another thing I'm excited about. In 36 days, I won't have to worry about curfew anymore. After dinner, my uncle and David go out onto the porch. David has brought 2 cigars, cheap ones, but still. And the smell of the smoke, sweet and spicy and just a little bit oily, floats in through the windows, intermingles with the sound of their voices, fills the house with blue haze. Rachel and Aunt Carol stay in the dining room drinking cups of watered-down, boiled coffee, the dirty pale color of old dishwater. From upstairs, I hear the sound of scampering feet. Jenny will tease Grace until she's bored, until she climbs into bed sour and dissatisfied, letting the dullness and sameness of another day lull her to sleep. I wash the dishes, many more of them than usual, since Carol insisted on having a soup. Hot carrot, which we all choke down, sweating. And a pot roast slathered in garlic and limp asparagus, probably rescued from the very bottom of the vegetable bin. And some stale cookies. I'm full, and the warmth of the dishwater on my wrists and elbows, plus the familiar rhythms of conversation, the pitter-patter of feet upstairs, the heavy blue smoke, make me feel very sleepy. Carol has finally remembered to ask about Rachel's children. Rachel goes over their accomplishments as though reciting a list she's only memorized recently, and with difficulty. Sarah is reading already. Andrew said his first word at only 13 months. Raid! Raid! This is a raid! Please do as you are commanded and do not try and resist! The voice booming from outside makes me jump. Rachel and Carol have paused momentarily in their conversation, are listening to the commotion in the street. I can't hear David and Uncle William either. Even Jenny and Grace have stopped fooling around upstairs. Patchy interference from the street, the sounds of hundreds and hundreds of boots clicking away in time, and that awful voice amplified through a bullhorn. This is a raid! Attention, this is a raid! Please be ready with your identification papers! A raid night. Instantly, I think of Hannah and the party. The room starts spinning. I reach out, grabbing onto the counter.
Seems pretty early for a raid, Carol says mildly from the dining room. We had one just a few months ago, I think.
February 18th, Rachel says. I remember David and I had to come out with the kids. There was some problem with SVS that night. We stood in the snow for half an hour before we could be verified. Afterward, Andrew had pneumonia for 2 weeks.
She relates the story as though she's talking about some minor inconvenience at the laundromat, like she's misplaced a sock. Has it been that long? Carol shrugs, takes a sip of her coffee. The voices, the feet, the static. It's all coming closer. The raiding parties move as one from house to house, sometimes hitting every house on a street, sometimes skipping whole blocks, sometimes going every other. It's random, or at least it's supposed to be random. Certain houses always get targeted more than others. But even if you're not on a watch list, you can end up standing in the snow, like Rachel and her husband, while the regulators and police try to prove your validity. Or, even worse, while the raiders come inside your house, tear the walls down, and look for signs of suspicious activity. Private property laws are suspended on raid nights. Pretty much every law is suspended on raid nights. We've all heard the horror stories. Pregnant women stripped down and probed in front of everybody. People thrown in jail for 2 or 3 years just for looking at a policeman the wrong way or for trying to prevent a regulator from entering a certain room.
This is a raid. If you are asked to step out of the house, please make sure you have all your identification papers in hand, including the papers of any children over the age of 6 months. Anyone who resists will be detained and questioned. Anyone who delays will be charged with obstruction.
At the end of the street, then a few houses away, then 2 houses away. No, next door. I hear the Richardson's dogs start barking furiously, then Mrs. Richardson apologizing. More barking, then someone, a regulator, mutters something, and I hear a few heavy thuds and a whimper, then someone else saying, "You don't have to kill the damn thing!" And someone else saying,
"Why not? Probably has fleas anyway."
Then for a while there's quiet. Just the occasional cackle of walkie-talkies, someone reciting identification numbers into a phone, the shuffling of papers. Then,
"All right, then. You're in the clear."
And the boots start up again. For all their nonchalance, even Rachel and Carol tense up as